Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 550. In this episode, Scott talks with Trust CEO Everett Harper about infrastructuralism and about how applying some old ideas in new ways helped them fix healthcare.gov.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Everett Harper. He's the CEO and founder at Truss. How are you, sir?
I am great. And thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, I'm happy to chat with you today. So we're going to talk about infrastructuralism, but talk to me about Truss first. You founded the idea. The original DNA for this was around 2011. How long have you been around?
Well, I've been personally around for 50 years, but but the company's been around since 2011. I think we really hit our stride around the time that healthcare.gov was breaking. And that sort of, we were one of the people that kind of helped save that and work with other great people to get that up and running and provide a lot of people with healthcare. So, and now we have 20 people. We're based in San Francisco and Oakland. And we help do software infrastructure. We consult with federal agencies, large companies doing transformation, and startups that are scaling. And really proud that we have 50% women who are engineers on our team. And it speaks to a lot of the things that we'll be talking about during the podcast.
Yeah, that's great. I understand your VP of engineering is a woman as well.
Yep. She's one of the founders. Brilliant. And my other co-founders, they're both technical, and I'm the non-technical head of a technical company, which is amusing, in many respects.
That's great. Well, I've gone and followed, Jennifer Leach, your VP of engineering and founder, and Mark for, his last name is Frilotti.
Frilotti, yeah.
A lot, as well on Twitter. So you said that you helped save healthcare.gov, but you said that the way that you phrased it was that you helped startups scale. And I think that healthcare.gov was a kind of a startup, wasn't it? That was having trouble scaling.
In some ways, it was the worst of both worlds. It was a startup in that I was trying to get something new done, but it's being run by a big entity which had a history more of doing command and control procedures. And unfortunately, those things clashed. And when they launched it, it didn't work, which is sort of amazing. Quickly, there's a couple leaders in the White House at USDS and 18F who were able to recognize we actually need a small team of elite engineers, and my co-founder, Mark Frilotti, was one of them. And they went in and did some amazing work in a very, very short period of time.
And was there was it just a matter of like find the smartest people and then you just, you know, they drop in like Mission Impossible from the ceiling and then the ninjas save everything? Or was it a method that made this possible? Was it geniuses or was it a way of thinking?
It was, I think it's actually a little bit of both. It was not a genius in the corner who goes and fixes the whole thing and ta-da. It was gathering people who have a lot of experience building modern systems, who had the humility and the passion to take their time out of their normal jobs because this was something important for the country. So there's a mindset there and the ability to work together and figure out who has the expertise and how can I help? That probably was the biggest thing that made it and drove the success of that project.
When I think of the government, I tend to think about silos of information, not information sharing. I think of silos of groups of people. While the government's this big giant system, it does seem to be very siloed.
It can be. I think there are places in agencies where there's some very big distinctions and very big differences. So I don't want to cast the entire government that way.
Of course.
I do think there are some interesting moves afoot where the systems of collaboration and communication are starting to be recognized as the way to go forward rather than holding things back and not releasing information to other groups who could potentially help or are affected by it.
Mm-hmm. When you're thinking about something as big as healthcare.gov, it was not just one system, but multiple systems interacting with each other, trying to present that information in a simple way to the user. So from a user-focused design perspective, it's go to a website and sign up. But the back end of that and all the systems behind it weren't just systems of computers, but there were systems of people and processes.
Yeah. So, and that system is really the core of where we think about infrastructuralism. And you had multiple vendors, one agency relying on multiple streams of information to do something that should be actually relatively simple. Go here, sign up, thumbs up, thank you. And because people looked at the problem as I do my little thing, I hand it off and I'm done, rather than looking at it at a system level that, hey, all these things need to work together. And by the way, when you put them together, we should test whether it works. That flipped when we and other people came in. And so for me, the whole infrastructuralism perspective is looking at systems of interactions. And it's required to operate a society or an enterprise. And in this case, the enterprise and society came together in a really important way. And I think that really galvanized my thinking around, hey, this is something that is urgent for us to talk about. So that's been fun to kind of explore more.
You know, it's interesting. I know we are speaking in generalization, so certainly we're not trying to generalize all people or all engineers or certainly not all of the government. But I think it's fair to say that we have worked with engineers in the past that tend to want to compartmentalize. We're taught as architects and software people to compartmentalize. And, you know, here's an interface by which you will talk to me, Everett, and you will speak on this bus, and this is how we will speak. And you give me this, and I'll give you that, and I'll work on my little thing, and you work on your little thing. And then the larger system, well, that's being architected by someone else. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm responsible for my thing. There's a lack of empathy there, though, for the entire system and the people who work in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that as a practice can be ameliorated by actually asking the question across whatever interface and going to sit next to the person who you're working with, an operator of a system, and saying, hey, what do you do? Show me how you work. Show me the things that drive you nuts and tell me about the things that you get excited about. What happens is, A, people love to talk about what they know, right? B, they get excited like someone actually asked me that I know something. In fact, I do know a lot of things. And then they will tell you so much information. And then as a person who's a consultant or a leader, when you start to see those patterns, you start to see, oh, actually, we don't have to talk through this interface. We can do something very different. We can work together and our communication can be trivial because of the way we work together. It casts off enough notifications that we don't actually need to sit and talk through email or talk through certain interfaces. We can actually see each other working. How cool is that? But most importantly, it sort of shows a basic level of respect for someone's knowledge and the ability for them to show what they know. That develops trust. And when you have that kind of trust, the kind of problems that result from silos start to melt away.
It seems also that you're going to the source of knowledge there and respecting the frontline people.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're going to, like, let's say you hired me to go and build a call center, it would be ridiculous for me not to sit with people at the front lines picking up the phones and understand who they are and how they think and how they work.
Yeah. I think the contribution that, you know, companies like IDEO with design thinking in particular made was, hey, go to the customers, look at customers walking in stores or interacting with with computer systems and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that idea, I'm sort of saying you actually also have to think about the operators of the systems in delivering those services. Your example of a call center is perfect. And who developed the software that the call center is operating on? How can you make their job easier? How can you have them deal with higher level problems? Well, you can actually sit there and sit next to them and say, hey, tell me how you do what your work is. So it's taking that design thinking idea and moving it back into people who develop the backend systems, the operating systems, the development environments. And there's a lot of knowledge captured there that I don't think is being utilized as well as it could be. And I think in our experience, when you do that, all sorts of new and innovative and exciting solutions start to come up.
Yeah. When I think of running software, I came up in the last 20, 25 years, just about when extreme programming, they used to call it XP, and now we call it agile, right? That idea of the active stakeholder, right? It always seemed intuitive to me that the person who is going to ultimately use the software should be an active and fundamental stakeholder, and that the on-site customer, right? The programmer should sit with the customer and get constant feedback about whether or not they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, there's in a lot of ways, infrastructuralism is really trying to take a lot of these ideas that have been in existence for a long time and apply them in a very particular way, and frankly, in a really urgent way, to deal with new problems that are coming up that we haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm. So where did this term infrastructuralism come from? Is there have we gone all the way back and figured out who had that idea or who coined that term?
There's a body of philosophical knowledge around structuralism. And that's existed, I think, certainly by the mid-20th century. And infrastructuralism really is kind of taking a little bit from that and riffing off of that. My inspiration, frankly, though, is coming from Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs. And for folks who don't know, these two did battle in the 1950s. Robert Moses was the urban planner for New York City, was responsible for a lot of the bridges. And his plan in the 50s, in a car-centric culture, was to put highways all through New York City. In particular, across Greenwich Village and wipe out Washington Square Park. Jane Jacobs was a resident of Greenwich Village. And she thought, wait a minute, cities are magic because of the people that are interacting on a block by block, nook by nook level. And they have the ability to solve problems locally because they are experiencing those problems. And the vibrancy that comes from cities is from these people figuring it out. So you had a command and control and a, what I would call, infrastructuralist perspective doing battle. Jane Jacobs won. We still have Washington Square Park. And the thing that's important about this, I think, is Moses, while he did amazing things for New York City, he was essentially command and control. And unfortunately, he could not have anticipated things like millennials not wanting to buy cars, or they wanting more connections, or people moving back into cities out of suburbs. Now we have, across the country, roads and infrastructure and so forth that's crumbling that people don't use as much. And it's only going to accelerate in the next 20 years as you get autonomous cars and things like that. Jane Jacobs kind of won the day. And I think understanding that, the lessons from that, are things that we understand in software and in building systems as well. So that's, for me, is the fun part was the inspiration for the idea of infrastructuralism.
And certainly, as an aside, it's a really interesting book called The Battle for Gotham that kind of, you know, expresses that battle between Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs. And I think that the interesting part of what you just said was the idea that there are things that we couldn't have anticipated. Certainly in the 60s, early 70s, there was this idea of that the future that we expected in the 50s was going to come to life in the 70s and 80s. And we would have, you know, these perfect little cars working in perfect little grids and find, you know, and highway, a countrywide highway, and everyone would be able to get there smoothly. So certainly Moses thought that it was going to be a beautiful New York if it had highways running all the way through it. We'd find, you know, it would be perfect. but it didn't think about the people.
Nope. No. People were going to adapt to that system rather than the other way around. Systems adapt to people and to context. And I think that's where the magic is Jane Jacobs nor Moses could anticipate that problem, but her perspective was at core adaptable.
That's a really, really good point, because now here we are in an environment where it's 2016. And while I kind of felt like I saw iPads coming, I really didn't think I saw self-driving cars coming this quickly. And now if we were in an inadaptable environment, we could potentially be in trouble, but hopefully we'll figure it out and we'll design cities that will be able to deal with that. I didn't see Uber coming. I don't know about you.
No. And things like climate change and well, people saw it in the 70s, the acceleration, I think, is taking everybody by surprise.
Interesting. So that brings up your point that you mentioned earlier about urgency. And it comes out of nowhere sometimes, but there's a complex problem, but then suddenly change accelerates. And there's these unknown factors that come up.
Yeah. And I think actually, just to back up a second, I think that I want to make sure that the idea behind a complex problem versus a complicated problem gets talked about a little bit. So a guy named Nassim Nicholas Taleb wrote this book. He talked about the black swans, about these problems that are extremely rare, cannot be predicted in advance because they're infinitesimally small probability, but have extreme impact. Mm-hmm. And typically people in retrospect say, oh, we could have anticipated that. So we're going to build all these systems to prevent that problem. And they miss the point. The point is there are things you can't predict. So what you do is you build systems and ways of thinking that can adapt to change and adapt to complex problems. So what's a complex problem? The best example is the difference between building a 747. It's a complicated problem to build a 747, but it's not a complex one. Complex problems are things like, how do you design a human society? I don't know. There are multiple dependencies and so many dependencies that it's hard to predict when you interact one thing with another, what's going to happen. So things like the financial crisis in 2008 is a perfect example of a complex problem. There wasn't one single source of the problem, but the impact was tremendous. And we're still reverberating. We're trying to figure out what to do with that.
I gotcha. So complex are things that have a lot of components, a lot of parts, but it doesn't necessarily express difficulty. But complicated definitely should have you thinking there's going to be a level of difficulty here.
Yeah, I think complicated is a known level of difficulty. Mm-hmm. Complex is an unknown level of difficulty. And in trying to design a system, if you don't appreciate the unknown part of it, you'll probably build a system that is fragile or rigid, and then it breaks when something that you don't anticipate comes along.
Okay. So then that maybe can bring us to some real world examples.
Sure. So there's a couple examples that I can bring up just from in my experience and, working with trust and so forth. So healthcare.gov is a really a good one. As we talked about earlier, lots of different inputs. But you should have been able to anticipate that you need to test it before it doesn't work. Test it so it works. When we went in, what problem do you fix when everything's on fire? What do you put the water on first? What they did was sort of set up a system that said, okay, let's first address the issue of how decisions get made and who has the ability to make those decisions. What they discovered was, engineers who really understood what the problem was had to go through four or five levels of approvals in order to be able to take an action. Well, I'm sure everybody in your audience knows that's a recipe for disaster. And so squishing that hierarchy and giving and empowering engineers to solve problems that they see made the complexity of all those decision trees reduce significantly. So that was the first thing. The second thing was, well, how do you choose which problem? Well, we took an approach of risk, creating a risk hierarchy. So what's the thing that's the biggest risk? Yeah, there's 17 things on fire. Let's just pick the one that we believe is the most risk. Address that this week. Next week, we address the next level. And the measure of whether you're doing the right thing is, are you addressing a higher level of problem this week than you did last week? Mikey Dickerson sort of coined this almost like Maslow's hierarchy of problem solving. Again, what it did was, it didn't say that we know what all the answers are. What it did say is we can solve certain problems and then look at the results and then solve the next level of problems. And eventually became a practice that empowered people to have momentum around solving something that seemed insurmountable at the start, and then started to be like, hey, I think we have a pattern here. I think we have some progress that we're making. That was an amazing collection of people who sort of were able to do that and involve other people who were working on the problem for 6 months or 12 months beforehand and engage them to help solve the problem as well.
How do these, I'm imagining these meetings happening and people, I mean, all the, you know, the whiteboarding and all the work that happens, the grunt work, how does that then get communicated down throughout a system so that everyone else feels that they have a general direction to go and they understand the marching orders, for lack of a better word?
Yeah. So in the general case, there are things, I mean, communication systems, whether you use, Pivotal or Jive to make the work you're doing visible, in a trivial way. Right. Slack is brilliant for the same reason. Mm-hmm. So that, and there's many others, but how, in my mind, it's how do you make the work that you're doing visible in a trivial way that doesn't require you to put extra attention to it? Cause like the core value here, right, is time and attention. We all want our time and attention valued. And if anything helps me put my time and attention on higher level problems to solve, I feel great. The second thing is really from sort of a leadership perspective, which is saying, A, I'm listening. Mm-hmm. B, you don't have to know everything. Like, there are going to be mistakes made. How quickly can you, identify the mistake, communicate the mistake, figure out a plan around the mistake, and then ensure that that same mistake doesn't repeat? There's a lot of places where mistakes are punishable instead of encouraged. Now, you don't want to make dumb mistakes, of course, right?
Sure, you're not
intending to. But when you have a culture that is punishing all mistakes, how often do you think that leader is hearing about mistakes that are that are happening on a daily basis?
That would be a culture that would be incentivized on hiding mistakes.
That's right. That's right.
And then you have a Wells Fargo situation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. It makes me think about one of the great things that I like about my boss was that he said that a number of people have said this, if you're not screwing up at least twice a year and getting in trouble, then you're probably not pushing hard enough and trying to do your job.
That's right. And that attracts certain people. And it's not something that it attracts certain people, and I think it's an adaptable organization. They find what the edge is, and then they bump up against it. And okay, great. That smacked me right in the head. Let's duck next time. Okay, cool. Great.
So I'm hearing you say that people would be listening more as opposed to just declaring from on high and commanding that this should be, that it shall be done like this. And then this system of constant improvement, but then setting up the system so that it doesn't break when something does break and it needs to be improved. And then you just, you know, fail fast, fail often, but you're always moving forward and always getting better.
Yeah. And, you know, you're trying not to fail, but you will. Mm-hmm. Right? That's just thing. There's, one of the other inspirations for me was a guy named John DeGioia, who's the chancellor of Georgetown. And, he was tasked with building a 21st century university. And he said, I'm trying to build a 21st century university with 200 years of academic history and then 2000 years of religious history, since it's a Jesuit university. And his whole framework, he boiled down to this: tolerance for uncertainty. Can you say, I might make a mistake as a leader, and will you follow me anyway? We have this goal. We have this vision. Do you trust me enough as a leader? And can I develop systems to make sure to earn that trust so that as we make mistakes, you still will follow me and we will solve this problem together? I think that's a really amazing statement. And because it's embedded in humility And it's also embedded in respect for the people who are doing the daily work. And that for me is sort of a core practice here, where you're a leader, not necessarily a manager. You're listening. You're not commanding. You're looking for improvement, and you're looking for a practice, so that every day you're getting a little bit better.
It's such a challenge, though, because I think particularly from an American culture perspective, we do sometimes lean towards leaders that show up and say, we've got it all figured out. You know, here, look, follow me over that hill. But a more empathetic in the listener, you know, a leader more than a manager is really what we need.
I think so. And I think I'd invite you and others to sort of say, so is that true in your own experience?
Hmm.
It looks good. It sounds right.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure you've interviewed leaders on your podcast and privately when they say to you, when they present this sort of I know everything kind of mode, mm-hmm. in private, there's a lot they don't know. And there's a lot they're concerned about. And people's experience, I think, will tell them a little bit more of the truth about, do you know everything that's going to happen?
Yeah. I definitely keep an eye out for anyone who makes unsupported declarative statements. You know, if you're, there's an old joke. I think it was Quentin Tarantino who said that he who is most likely to make declarative statements is most likely to be called a fool in retrospect.
Yep. I
absolutely.
Yeah. There's a lot there.
So then where can people who are listening start? Like, this might be an inspirational podcast. This is a great discussion, but from the perspective of someone who is literally at this moment, as we speak, driving to work. And thinking about how they can apply that in their job at wherever they're headed to.
Yeah.
It might be overwhelming.
Yeah. And I'm glad you asked it and framed it as sort of you're going to work, because while this is a long-term perspective and we're looking at long-term problems, it's really a practice that you can start every day, any day. So if you're driving into work and you get into work, think about in your meeting, how much you ask questions versus give answers. And see if you can flip it and ask the questions of the people in the room about a certain aspect and almost don't even give any answers. Don't even make any declarative statements.
Hmm.
A second one is, instead of an email or Slack conversation, what if you go to somebody's desk who is an operator of the system that you use? And you just sit next to them and say, can you show me how you do a simple thing? And then sit back and just observe. And maybe you see some things that you're like, wow, I had no idea. I can solve that for you. I didn't know that was frustrating. I think the another one is kind of, if you're starting a project, look at the list of things that you have to do and really think about and collaborate on this. What's the biggest risk? Where is the biggest risk here? And then have the courage to say, what if we do that thing first? And it's going to shock, it may shock people like, oh no, that's too big a problem. We want to do other things. Like, no, let's do that. Because if we can tackle this thing, everything else becomes easier and simpler. What an amazing thing to accomplish right away. And then the last I would say is, if you're trying to improve something either for your customer, your collaborator, or the person operating your system, or even your boss, think about what is a thing that can deliver time and attention back to them? How can you take their attention off of something that really doesn't need to be dealt with, instead giving them more of that attention to something that might be more interesting, more meaningful, and more purposeful? I think those are like some sort of concrete things that really hit on some of the themes that we're talking about. But I'm also going to be writing a lot more about this on our blog at trust.works. And I'm on Medium as well, and I'll be writing a little bit more about that as well. And we'll make sure to have some resources, because a lot of this comes from inspirations from books and things that I've read and people that I've talked to. We'll have it on the blog. On your blog, sorry.
Yeah, it sounds like you are a... you're a prolific reader, and you're absorbing and discarding and absorbing and picking what makes sense and discarding what doesn't make sense as you move forward. I think it's another reminder to people who may be heading to work right now that there can be dry spells, and you might go a couple of months without reading a new book or thinking about a new idea or discovering a new concept. Here's an opportunity to maybe turn that around and explore an entirely new space.
Yeah, I think being able to make connections between different genres and different modes of practice gets really, really interesting. I know there's a very brief time, but I'll give one other thing that you might want to check out, which is Dave Brailsford, who's the coach of Team Sky, who won the Tour de France in 3 years when he was tasked to do it for five, has this concept called getting 1% better. It is phenomenal because it really addresses this idea of improvement and starting small and getting better. And we'll put the link in the podcast.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Everett Harper, for chatting with me today.
Yeah, this has been really, really fun. I appreciate being able to talk about this. For me, this is really fun stuff, and I hope it's been useful and meaningful. And I encourage people to come on and let's talk and let's figure more of it out.
All right. We'll have links to all of Everett's work and his team's work, and you can check them out at trust.works. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. See you again next week.